This recording has been made by the Very Reverend Miles M. Burke, member of the Catholic Biblical Association of America. The title of Monsignor Burke's talk is The Temptation of Jesus. This recording is protected by copyright. Permission for reproduction must be secured from the Catholic Biblical Association.
The Temptation of Jesus. The account of the temptation of Jesus is found in Matthew chapter 4, verses 1 through 11, in Luke chapter 4, verses 1 through 13, and in much shorter form, in Mark chapter 1, verses 12 and 13. It is probably even a better example than the baptism account of the theological interpretation given in the Gospels to the events of Jesus' life, because there is good reason to think that what is presented in this case as a single incident is not something which actually took place at any one particular point of time in the ministry of Jesus. In that respect, the temptation account is quite different from that of the baptism. Although the baptism event has been theologically interpreted by the reflections made upon it by the gospel writers, it was a single historical event occurring at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. But while the temptation is also portrayed as a single incident, which took place directly after the baptism, it is at least probable that in that case, the Christian community in which the account was formed gave a description under the guise of a single happening of something that had happened frequently in Jesus' life, namely, his being tempted by Satan to assume a type of messianism which was contrary to the will of his Father. The close relation between the Matthean and the Lucan account of the temptation is very plain. It is true that Luke has dealt differently with the order of the temptations than Matthew. The temptation of Jesus to hurl himself from the pinnacle of the temple, which of course has Jerusalem as its setting, is the second temptation in Matthew and the final one in Luke. That is really the only significant difference between the two accounts. And since it is reasonably certain that Matthew did not know the Gospel of Luke or Luke the Gospel of Matthew, their close similarity in this instance is an indication that there already must have existed in the traditions which each of the evangelists had received a fairly well-developed temptation account. Luke's change of order, whereby the last temptation is made the one at Jerusalem, is in accordance with the literary form, the traveled story, which Luke has used in writing his gospel. He has presented the ministry of Jesus as a progress of Jesus from Galilee to Jerusalem, where the climax of the life of Christ, his death and resurrection, takes place. In order to maintain that climactic position of Jerusalem, he eliminated any reference to the Galilean appearances of the risen Jesus. In Luke, all of the appearances of Christ after his resurrection take place in Jerusalem. To transfer the scene to Galilee again would be an anticlimax. That preoccupation of Luke to present Jesus' ministry as a progress from Galilee to Jerusalem was a predominant concern of his, and it would seem that the reason why he put the last temptation at Jerusalem was to give a foreshadowing, so to speak, of what his entire gospel was going to bring out. The first victory of Christ over Satan comes to its climax in the holy city, which will be in time the place of the final and definitive battle between Satan and the Lord, and of the final and definitive victory of Jesus over Satan. Apart from that difference of order, there is, as we have said, no important difference between the Matthean and the Lucan account. Mark, on the contrary, is so different from both Matthew and Luke in this passage that most scholars think that Mark's account comes from a different source. However, there are those who believe that Mark has radically shortened an account quite similar to that found in the other two Gospels. Those who hold that view think that there is a hint of the origin of the Markan account in the statement of Mark that during his temptation, Jesus was with the wild beasts. Thereupon, the Spirit sent him away into the wilderness, and there he remained for 40 days, tempted by Satan. He was among the wild beasts, and the angels waited on him. Several interpretations have been given to that detail. Some consider it one of those vivid traits which are peculiar to Mark's gospel. Others see in it a profound symbolism. Jesus is the new Adam who is with the beasts as Adam was with the beasts in the Garden of Eden. But those who find in it the indication that Mark's temptation account is derived from one which was originally quite similar to those now found in Matthew and Luke, believe that there is a connection between that detail of Mark and the quotation from Psalm 90, which is put in the mouth of Satan in the other two Gospels. He will give his angels command concerning you, and they will lift you up with their hands, lest you strike your foot against a stone. You remember that in Psalm 90 it was said of the hero of the psalm not only that he would enjoy that protection of the angels, but that he would tread upon the asp and the viper and trample down the lion and the dragon. He would have no reason to fear the wild beasts. And it may be that Mark's passing reference to the beasts is an indication that he knew the temptation account in which Psalm 90 was utilized, and that his reference is one of the few elements which he retained in his drastic shortening of the account. That view of the relationship between Mark, Matthew, and Luke may be right, or it may be that Mark's account is independent of the other two. At all events, the Matthean and Lucan accounts are, recognizably, substantially the same, and it is of the Matthean account that I should like to speak with you. The moral interpretation, as it is called, of the temptations of Jesus is one that has had a long history in the church, but it seems to be about as wrong as it is old. The meaning which those who follow that interpretation find in the account is that the temptations of Jesus are those which all men undergo, and Jesus sets an example of how his followers are to resist them. St. Ambrose, for instance, thinks that the temptations were to gluttony, boastfulness, and ambition for earthly goods, respectively. St. Augustine, that they were temptations to concupiscence of the flesh, vainglory, and curiosity. Curiosity, in this case, meaning the desire to see whether the angels would really sustain him if he jumped from the temple pinnacle. St. Gregory the Great, that they were temptations to gluttony, vainglory, and avarice for power. Now, while it may be admitted that in proposing that moral interpretation, the Church Fathers said some valuable things about temptation, it does not seem that they gave any real insight into the meaning of the Gospel texts. Fundamentally, Jesus' temptations could never be experienced by any other individual than himself because they were messianic temptations. It is possible, of course, for the messianic community, the church, to undergo similar temptations. And as we look at her history, we see both glorious examples of how she reacted as Jesus did, and also the darker picture of how she sometimes failed the test. But these temptations could not be undergone by the individual follower of Christ because they are temptations of Jesus precisely as Messiah. And though each has a different nuance, all three have this in common. They depict an attempt of Satan to have Jesus assume a type of messianism which was not in accordance with the will of his Father. It is important to notice the close connection which is made between Jesus' baptism and his temptation. Not only does the temptation account follow directly after that of the baptism, but the way in which Satan addresses Jesus is clearly reminiscent of what the voice from heaven has said at the baptism. There the Father acknowledged Jesus as my beloved Son. Here, Satan approaches him with the words, if you are the Son of God, command that these stones become loaves of bread. It is clear, I think, that in this case, as in that of the baptism account, the term Son of God is not meant in the full sense of divine, pre-existent Son, co-equal with the Father. If it were to be so understood, the whole temptation account would become pointless. One does not attempt to lead God into sin. The title is to be taken, rather, with the meaning of Messiah, and specifically, because of its connection with the words of the Father in the baptism account, in the sense of Messiah, servant of the Lord, which is what the Father has proclaimed him. I think that we can also say quite certainly that the evangelist does not wish to suggest that Satan is trying to find out if Jesus was really the servant Messiah. The fact that he uses the title given Jesus in the baptismal theophany shows that Satan knew that he was, and his purpose in tempting Jesus is to have him be unfaithful to his destiny. There is a typology that runs through the account which is sometimes overlooked. Jesus is the new, obedient Israel, antitype of the old. That is a theme which is found in other passages of Matthew also. His presence in the Matthean infancy narrative is particularly clear in Matthew chapter 2, verse 15, where Jesus' return from Egypt is said to be the fulfillment of the prophecy of Hosea, out of Egypt have I called my son. In Hosea, of course, the son is the nation Israel. In Matthew, it is Jesus. We find the Jesus-Israel typology also in the baptism account, where Jesus is portrayed as the representative head of the new people of God, the new Israel. It is not surprising, therefore, that that typology should be found in the temptation account, and that the experience of Jesus should be portrayed as a reliving by him of an experience which Israel had undergone, with quite different results, however. Now, if one looks at the scriptural quotations, which in the gospel account of the temptation are placed on the mouth of Jesus in his responses to Satan, he sees that they are all taken from the book of Deuteronomy, and specifically from passages in Deuteronomy which deal with the temptations of Israel, either in the wilderness while journeying from Egypt to the Promised Land, or in Canaan after the entrance of the tribes into Palestine. It is interesting to notice that the way in which the temptation account begins also recalls Deuteronomy. Jesus is led into the desert by the Spirit to be tempted by the devil. God led Israel into the desert in order to test her. Like ancient Israel, Jesus is led into the desert to be tested. The difference between the two situations is that in the testing, Jesus proves himself the obedient and faithful Son, whereas Israel did not. Let us look now at the explicit quotations from Deuteronomy with which Jesus answers Satan. The tempter came and said to him, if you are the Son of God, command that these stones be turned into loaves of bread. And the answer of Jesus, taken from Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 3, is, it is written, not by bread alone does man live, but by every word which proceeds from the mouth of God. Now, although that answer has been taken by some to mean, man does not live by material food alone, but needs the spiritual nourishment that comes from the hearing of the word of God, that does not seem to be the meaning at all, either in Matthew or in Deuteronomy. Let us look at the text in Deuteronomy. Moses speaks to the Israelites. Remember how for 40 years now the Lord your God has directed all your journeying in the desert, so as to test you by affliction and find out whether or not it was your intention to keep his commandments. He therefore let you be afflicted with hunger, and then fed you with manna, a food unknown to you and your fathers, in order to show you that not by bread alone does man live, but by every word that comes forth from the mouth of God. Deuteronomy chapter 8, verses 2 and 3. The incident that text of Deuteronomy refers to is one described in the book of Exodus, chapter 16, verses 2 through 12. It would be valuable to consider it for a moment in order to see the meaning of the statement of Deuteronomy and of Jesus using that statement in his answer to the devil. Then the whole Israelite community grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the desert. The Israelites said to them, "Would that we had died at the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, as we sat by our flesh pots and ate our fill of bread. But you had to lead us into this desert to make the whole community die of famine." Then the Lord gives Moses the promise that he is going to rain down bread from heaven for the people. And when Moses and Aaron tell this to them, Moses points out, "Your grumbling has not really been against us, but against the Lord." Notice here that we have Israel expressing what amounted to a wish to repudiate her destiny. The Exodus, God's leading his people out of Egypt, was rightly regarded in the traditions of Israel as the great act of God's graciousness, an essential element in the progress of events by which Israel became the people of God. And according to the passage which we have just seen, the Israelites were ready to repudiate all that. Would that we had died in the land of Egypt. Why did you, Moses and Aaron, lead us out of Egypt, where we had plenty to eat? This complaint, this grumbling, was the first great failure of Israel in the test to which God subjected her in the desert.